بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم نحمد ونصلي على رسول الكريم. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. الحمد لله, we praise Allah سبحانه وتعالى. Ask him to send peace and blessings on his beloved and our beloved Sayyidina Muhammad صلى الله عليه وسلم. So last week we were up to this slide, and just make it a bit bigger on my screen so I can see clearly. It's a lot of writing and it's very small. And we were in up to this slide. We discussed so far. What we discussed is a brief history of the initial period of fiqh, then the era or the four imams specifically, and the developments and their history and their books and so forth. And then the idea of the madhhab, or sticking to a madhhab, or having this existence of even the schools, what matters upon which all the scholars agree upon. Historically, what the ulama said. So the first thing, of course, all reject and reproach fanaticism, ta'assub, tribalism, whatever you want to call it. That is partisanship. There's different words, it's translators. But basically, all agree that someone marrying, saying that you can't marry because he's from another madhab, or disassociating, or making it as a point of loyalty and association, disassociation based on the madhab and having enmity towards the followers of another madhab, that this is something blameworthy and something that is not befitting a Muslim and should not be encouraged. And it's something the seniors of all these madahib, the senior imams and fuqaha and jurists, are very far from. And the second part is the acceptance of the existence of madhabs or schools, and not to call towards their abolishment or abandonment, and or the extreme form is like people say, we're going to burn the books. This is something is not very far away. There's people here in our city here, once upon a time, they're going to burn this book and burn that book because of this sort of anti. And as Sheikh Amir al-Bahjat in the original Arabic of this course said, once upon a time, the ta'assub was for your school, and now the ta'asub is against the schools. And then the third point, what we're up to, is that if someone who adheres to a madhab reaches a level of ijtihad, and I'll explain the independent reasoning, and differs with the view of the imam of his own madhab and gives a preference to another imam's view, then this is considered good and praiseworthy. But this is conditional on that he's ahl for that. Ijtihad is not just to be thrown around. Tarjih, preferring a view, is an ijtihad. Giving a preference to one view of the other is an ijtihad. And if you're not ahl for it, then it's not permissible for you to engage in that until you become ahl of that. And that's not an easy process. So just to give you an idea that the ulama, especially in the Hanafi madhab, one of the great fuqaha, he graded the mujtahids like into different levels. Historically, there's only like three categories, but he went into more details. I think it's seven categories, right? That and Mufti Taqi Usmani, one of the great scholars of our time, Allah give him good health, and he's our teacher's teacher. And when he was asked about, you know, like, is he from like the second last category? That's considered like in like, so if you put Imam Hanifa and the four Imams, Imam Muhammad Abu Yusuf in the first category, then you understand like there's like six categories between, five categories between to the last one. The last one is just an alim who's a muqallid. Pretty much most of the ulama today, definitely those who graduated Medina University, Riyadh University, Umm al-Qura, Azhar, see, these are in the last category, right? They're muqallids, they follow somebody else. They don't have the expertise or the thing. It's very hard to do ijtihad in the real sense of ijtihad. Today, generally when new ijtihad is done, it's done collectively. There are fiqh councils now where large groups of scholars, great scholars, they get together, and because this requires so much and that ability is not there. So anyway, so it doesn't apply to the graduates of madrasas like myself, or graduates of mufti courses, or graduates. That's a very different level of ijtihad that we are talking about. But again, so this is not just like people freestyling it, as many people might do in this time. And if someone is ahl for that and they have an independent view, this is something praiseworthy, it's not blameworthy, but it has to be ahl, right? So Shaykh Amir Bahjat gave a very simple example. The example was of the mas لا يمص إلا المطهرون. So no one should touch it except for the purified. And referring to the touching of the Quran, and what does it mean that only those who are purified, the only being purified? So of course in tafsir that views that only the angels, right? So some people who read open up one tafsir today, like the ijtihad, just to he illustrated this with an example of sort of the low level ijtihad that could not even really be considered an ijtihad. It's almost a mockery of ijtihad that a person said, well, in this tafsir it says this, and since not all of the mufassirin agree on this, hence we will take it that you can touch the Quran because it refers to malaika, it could refer to people, then we'll take it as referred to malaika, then hence if you touch the Quran without wudu, it's fine. This is a superficial, very low IQ. I don't know how to say it, like it's not much thought is put into such an ijtihad, suppose quote unquote ijtihad. And if you ask these type of people, what they've actually done is like they're not even making. So they said, okay, we're not going to do taqlid, we're not going to stick to a school. But then what they present in this place of the madhab or a school is like, did you look at all the athar, all the narration? I mean, most of these people don't even know the athar. They're very far from the athar. Athar meaning the narrations. Well, one is a hadith itself from Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam, other than the Quran, obviously. Then thirdly is the narrations from the sahaba, the imams of the sahaba radiallahu anhum, the tabi'een. What have they got to say about it? So it's very superficial, service level, quote unquote, and I say this sarcastically, ijtihad. Have you studied all the sanid of, like, let's say on this, if there's a narration, have you studied all the chains of the narration to pass a judgment like this? As an example, Sheikh Ahmed, he puts an example forward of like a narrator has been critiqued regarding a certain masal, less than the masal of touching the Quran without wudu, and that it applies to people. And the person has, let's say, passed judgment of du'af, weakness. The narrator has 1,600 narrations attributed to him. And most of them are reliable. He's considered a reliable narrator overall. He has five that of his narrations, as an example, that differ with more stronger narrators. One that is very clear, one is a little bit different, and one is very clear. Now, this imam, this narrator, one narrator on the chain of one hadith, right? He says that the early imams, like Imam Ahmad, or Imam Shafi'i, who knew the chains from them to Rasulullah, all the variations, right? On a single narrator. And they know the ins and outs because the way they studied is very different to the way we study today. They had to, as part of their learning process, and their study was very extensive, despite their genius and memory and so forth. Just think about this. Imam Ahmad, as an example, started his ilmi studies, formal ilmi studies in his teens, mid-teens, 15 or something like that, like formal studies. With their piety, with their knowledge, where they lived in Baghdad. And then he didn't get married till the age of 40. So he's dedicated 25 years of his life to memorization, understanding of the narrators, their chain. So as they were learning, they were accumulating the information of every narrator, rating them, grading them, and so forth. And then they found that on a certain hadith that this person has made an error based on what other narrators are looked at as well. He said, if you apply that process, given the, like let's say an alim in isolation, someone graduated out of a Darul Uloom or a madrasa or a institution or an Islamic university, and then he would have to go through that one narration with one narrator. He said he will end up spending a year, not the whole chain, on this one narration. And people today, they are passing judgment based on the taqlid of other muhaddiseen. So this is what Shahmer, he wanted to highlight, because people don't understand when they're saying abandon the school and we're going to do tarjih, we're going to give preference to a review on what's more stronger, without understanding that the imams already did that based on a sound set of principles. That's what the school is. And then when they are giving that, they all those information, all that meta information that's there has been factored into their decision, right? And if just think about that one narrator, it takes 1 year, the next year you'll have to do the next narrator. I mean, That level of ijtihad is not even possible today, because that level of information in a single mind is today is unheard of, right? Let alone forget the fact that Imam Ahmad, as an example, as one of the Imams, who knew 1 million hadith by heart, right? So think about what was involved ijtihad. Sheikh Amer, he wants to emphasize what is ijtihad of the early Imams as opposed to later Imams. And when you're going to say, I'm going to go through the hadith encyclopedias and an analysis of an Imam, like an alim of today who's giving you tarjih or tanqid, he's giving you a criticism of a hadith. He's basing it, it's not like he's directly getting it from Rasulullah Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam or from Sahaba radiallahu anhum. He's going through the encyclopedias of the narrators, which were done like 500 years later, 300 years later. Yeah, they accumulate all the meta information into books. Now, a third, fourth, fifth century, I'm not talking about the original compilers of the collections with the chain of narration like Imam Bukhari and others. I'm talking about later ones who analyze each person, right? So now you are becoming a muqallid, you're becoming a follower of those people who wrote those books, right? What they are preferring, that's what you're preferring. And the Imams of Ijtihad, like the four Imams, they came earlier, right? So this like the memorization, so people just open the Quran, and they do this sort of superficial ijtihad from footnotes. In reality, what is ijtihad of a mujtahid? The usuliyun, the usuli scholars, this experts on usul, they say that it is istifragu faqihi wus'a fi daraki hukm shari'. So basically, the mujtahid, when he does ijtihad, is he absolutely exhausts, right, all his energies into the furthest depth and extent of a masala sharia, of a hukm sharia. Do you understand? It's not done like on the fly. It's not done on a whim. It's not done on surface level. He's like gone so deep into the nook and cranny of that masala, and after in the wind and Be, and what the Usuli scholar said, there's nothing left after that. Like it's been turned inside out, every corner, nook, and cranny. Then a ruling is given by a mujtahid. That's what, when you talk about the four Imams or the other Imams, the early Imams whose schools didn't survive, that's what they were doing. With all that information, right? All the narration, the hadith, ayat, and all the fatawa, Sahaba radiallahu anhum, and all the meta information about the narrators, the incidents, the history, make sure this is proper, the corroboration between it. Right, the corroboration between all these rawis and narrators, right? So this type of ijtihad of the mujtahid is something unique, and it's not repeated afterwards. It's not even possible to repeat it afterwards, the depth that they did that. So today you'll see people that are very negligent and ignorant in this aspect. Modern researchers don't look at Sahaba radiallahu anhum even. A lot of modern researchers or modernist researchers, when they do a ruling, just give me one moment. Apologies. Yeah, so modern researchers, they don't they're very negligent. I've seen this myself in dealing certain masail, certain ayat of Quran. And when you open the tafsirs like of the great ulama of the past, like the reference of tafsir, like Qurtubi and Tabari and so forth. You'll notice that modern research intentionally will ignore the Sahaba radiallahu anhum. Because Sahaba radiallahu anhum, they and the early Imams, they will give you the meaning of it, and they sort of they push it to the side and they give their own interpretation. And so they're either willfully ignorant or negligent in this matter. The modern way of tarjih, preference, like in views, let's say there's ikhtilaf in an issue, there's a difference of opinion. So some people, they take averages, they do averages, right? They will take, like you take the highest value, the lowest value, and take the average, you get a middle value. That they treat tarjih like that between the madahib, and so they so it's like really the fatwas of averages. This is not a proper methodology, right? This is not a real methodology. It's just a made-up methodology because we study maths at school. They're applying it to, they'll take the max, the minimum, and then they'll take the average. The third, they'll have like they'll put all the views, and then they say, well, this seems like the middle view, right? So the median, they'll take the median according to them, right? So these sort of or they'll just say what is the easiest thing to apply, right? So this is, look, in extreme necessities. In extreme necessities, the Sharia does allow concession and ease for the slave. His Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has built that ease, is built facilitate within that. The problem is when you're trying to make things easy that are not supposed to be. People, there are groups appeared. My father, rahmullah, was when he was in Imam in Switzerland. One specific sect that was saying, they just tell their followers, you can pray all your salat at the end of the day because you're in a working day. And, even in Australia, once upon a time, people were thinking of doing Jummah on a Sunday. I mean, this is like they're making things easier more than what the Sharia has prescribed, right? So, and another example Sheikh Ahmed gave in the course is that, for example, like three divorces being three, and people will come up and they'll say things like, Islam is a deen of mercy, and therefore we should be easy, and it's going to break up the family. And they'll give such a sob story about the situation that a person will, I mean, you'll be brought to tears. We have to protect the family and keep the family together. Yes, that's all good, but that's not a way to make a hukm. Firstly, if especially the hukm is established from the Quran and from the Sunnah, now we're trying to change it based on the external conditions to the point of that we're ignoring the nas. We're actually changing, ignoring and totally disobeying what Allah and His Rasul has told us. So all these sort of emotions are being brought into it as well. And the preference is given is so people don't get upset, right? So these type of things are being done now. Because people can detach from a systematic madhab or school. And so Sheikh Ahmed wants to, he in the course, this course, these notes are in front of you, they're from his lecture in Arabic. And what he's explaining in these notes is to make sure that we understand that ijtihad is not just research the way we think it is. It's a much more deeper and complex work. And this is why the great imams. So you'll have Imam Nawawi rahmullah as a Shafi'i, and you'll have Ibn Qudam al-Maqdisi as a Hanbali, and you'll have Qarafi as a Maliki, and you'll have Imam Kasani who's a Hanafi. Great imams, geniuses, great writers, Imam Saraqsi, on and on and on. Great mental discipline, but they knew their place in front of the mujtahid. They knew that, oh, I can't. Despite the fact that they have original contribution to the schools, to fiqh and Islam in general, they wrote so much. All these people, the names that I gave you, they all contributed so much to Islam. But when it came to this issue of fiqh, they felt it necessary they stay within a school, within a framework. Because they knew their place in scholarship, that no, they were not on par with Imam Hanifa, Imam Shafi, Imam Malik, Imam. Thing. Even though some people today who might just graduate out of an Islamic university or a madrasa might falsely self-delude themselves and think like that. Today, we have people who, when it comes to the nafs, inclination towards the nafs is a lot. And in inclination towards the desires is a lot today. But if a person is inclined towards a Shafi school, he may follow Shafi school. But he shouldn't pass judgment Imam Ahmad as example that Imam or Imam Hanifa and say Imam Hanifa opposed the Quran and Sunnah. Right? We are not in a place to sit judge over those people. We're very, very far, especially the Imams of the Salaf like Imam Hanifa, Imam Malik, Imam Ahmad, these Imams and their schools and their judgments. Like we're not in a position, we're very far from that. So this is very important. However, if a scholar exercises independent reasoning and he's recognized among the scholarly body of the Muslims that he's someone who's able to exercise ijtihad in whatever capacity, because it's not like, all right, he's not Imam Hanif or Imam Shafi, the four Imams, but within the school, he's got some say and he can contribute original ideas. And when I say original ideas, I mean he's got a contribution in expanding the school. Then, he'll be treated according to his level. And we're taught in Islam, Anzalu nasa manazilahum, to treat people according to their level. We don't disregard their originality, their contribution, and so forth. They are processed within these frameworks, right? The fourth point regarding agreement of the madhhab, or sticking to a madhhab, to accept that adhering to a madhhab is like graduating from a principal school of fiqh, which is supported by dalils and proofs and also seeks the strongest proof. Right, so this is something that each school is always constantly, and that's one of the benefits of having multiple schools. People say, no, it should be just one. Well, these four schools are like self-check mechanism within the Sharia. Each school has to make sure, based on sound principles that are from the Quran Sunnah, that their school is like more valid and more stronger. And they will debate this, and they'll have, I mean, I'm talking about academic debate. The book is here somewhere. I did study it last year. The seven notes. Jazakallah khair. I'll make a note of it later, inshallah, at the end of this session. I'll see if I can bring him up. Yeah, so Sheikh Ahmed emphasized this point that after the pretty much within like a century of these schools existing, the four and others, you'll find that any alim of any worth is associated with one of these big schools, and he gave many names. There are the madrasa, the madhab should be seen as a school. Like I always give the example, their frameworks, right? And he said, it's, and even someone says their name is attributed like he's a Hanbali, Ibn Rajab al Hanbali, or so and so Shafi'i, or so and so Hanafi. Not a big deal. This is not an issue. This is intisab is permissible. Affiliation with the school. Like someone says that he's Azhari. Or someone says Dar'ami. Dar'ami is Darul Ulum in Egypt. Darul Ulum. So they like at the end of their name, they have their thing. Someone studied in a madrasa, like they'll have like a name that's connected to that. So that it shows the affiliation to the school, right? This is as long as it's not like done out of like partisanship or out of what do you call it? Tribalism and to put down others and put yourself up, well, then it's fine. This is not an issue, right? And I mentioned this before, I mentioned again, Sheikh Adnan Naham in Kuwait, when I asked him, he said, for the average person, their madhab is a local imam, historically. For the Talib al-Ilm, who should enter the madras of a madhab, a school of madhab. As an example, you have a medical college in Melbourne, you have a medical college in England, and you have a medical college in, let's say, the US. All three are quote unquote first world countries. Right, and they have very similar medical systems. All three are very, very similar in the standards of medicine and so forth, you would assume, right? And but each medical college or each of these universities, let's say Melbourne University and Harvard and Oxford, let's say in all three, or Monash, where I went to in Melbourne, right? This is considered for it's famous for its medical research and whatnot. If all these three universities, their medical faculties, although very similar, they'll have different structures. You cannot say that that is what is in Melbourne or Monash here, that university, that it is a carbon copy of the one in Harvard or in the one in Oxford. They'll have their own quirks, their own way of training their students, the future doctors. No one will say that none of these are wrong, although the goal is the same, to produce a healer, a person who treats and the people's ailments and so forth. And will serve human beings and so forth. And some will do plastic surgery, but unnecessarily, but the most of them will go and to treat people for their ailments, right? Which is the goal. But and they're very similar, but they're also different as well. Their scheduling might be different. The tarbiyah they might do is different, right? Based on sound principles. There's a reason why they do the way they do. The modus operandi comes from a set of principles, right? So nobody will say this one is wrong, that one's right, right? They have different experiences, different ways that develop, and so and no one can say they're wrong. They're all correct in their own way. So a madrasa, madhab should be seen like as a madrasa, as a school like that. And As long as there's no ta'assub in that. The last point, permissibility of an adherent to a madhab, sticking to the views of the imam of the school that he affiliates with. The satisfaction that the imam's view is based on careful consideration of the proofs of that view. That a madhab is not doesn't come out of thin air. There is discussions, there's a debates, there are sound principles and cautiousness with great fear of Allah. A ruling was devised and made part of that school, right? Based on the Quran and Sunnah. So a person has to have confidence that this view, according to Madhab X, like that I follow, such a madhab. So I follow him. If you're permitting, and people that are critical of madhabs, they've got a problem because they're saying they attack the madhab and they said, follow me or my teacher, right? If you are permitting someone to follow you, meaning your taqlid, right? And then you have to say that it is permissible if you're permitting your own taqlid for your sheikh or yourself. Then you are obliged to also say that it's permissible to follow, make taqlid of the imams. Like if you're putting forward your own understandings of the Quran and Hadith, right? Then you have to accept the understandings of the Quran and Hadith of the four imams. And their taqlid is more safer than your taqlid, with all due respect to whoever the sheikh is of this time, how pious, good, and so forth. But for me, those ones, and I think for most the ummah and the imams and ulama of the ummah throughout history said, no, they're a safer bet. They were more cautious, they had more ilm, and they had more taqwa. If someone asks a mufti who's a mujtahid, right? Sorry, that's yeah, we'll go to the next slide. Now, these are now some issues where there is a point of difference. The actual ruling on tamadhub, like, is it so? Some will say it's wajib, right? That following a madhab is wajib, right? So, this is the view of like Sheikh Amin al-Shinqiti, rahmullah, said the later usuli scholars, the legal theory experts, the usul scholars, usuliyin, that said from all the madahib agree that it is wajib. Why is it that later usuli scholars are saying this? Once they saw that the changes in the people, the scholars saw the changes in the people, and they saw the changes in the people and the corruption, the guardrails needed to be more, right? And a simple principle you see, I was discussing this with the Mufti this week, that in the current situation of Gaza and whatnot, right? A lot of stuff has infiltrated the Muslim community because we've got our guard down at the moment, politically and so forth. So a lot of things under the people wrap themselves in Gaza. It's important that we deal with the Muslims' problems and so forth. But we have to be very, very careful that under these things don't become a Trojan horse. Yes, we have to attend to the alleviate the suffering of our Muslim brothers and sisters. Yes, but we have to be also on guard. And this is something that the fuqaha, their job is. Their job is not, they have to be on guard to make sure that the deen is not changed. This is the beauty of our deen, that the Quran cannot be changed and that the Sunnah of Rasulullah cannot be changed and the practice of Islam are preserved so that we don't drop our guard and we change the Sharia or the deen. So this is why the later scholars were much more cautious. And I'll give you an example. Imam Safarin, rahmullah, about 200 something years ago, he writes a refutation on not sticking to one mother. And who is he writing the refutation? He's writing on another Hanbali imam, great imam in the mazhab, Mar'i Ibn Yusuf, rahmullah, who was 150 years before him. It's about 400 years ago. That he's the 400 years ago fatwa is more lenient, while the 150 year one like becomes more strict because of what's happening in the world. They're seeing, and you see that in the Sahaba radiallahu anhum as well. Sayyidina Aisha radiallahu anha, the mother of the believers, Sayyidina Aisha radiallahu anha, she said, if Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam saw the woman of today, he'll not let them go to the masjid. Right? And you see, like, what's she noting? That corruption, societal corruption, changes, and so forth. And she's adjusting the hukam and the cautiousness in there. Yes, women are allowed to go to the mosque, but there's other factors to take consideration because it's not even fard on them. And if there's other harms are going to come, then we have to, you know, depending on the society, time, and place. I'm not going to talk about the details of that fatwa, but I'll just give you an example. A thought is put into it. So the latest scholars, why they're like that? Why? Because they're seeing that people are going to make mockery of deen if they're not disciplined in a structured. I'll give you another example. One of the is a young brother. He was mentioning to me about the Bosnian mosque here, very close, the closest mosque to me. And he said they're very strict about the 20 rakat tarawih, but they don't do the Khatam Quran, but they do to. I said, yeah, that's a good thing. Why would you want to spoil that? You know, like they make like fard almost. Like I mean, they're disciplined in it. So something has been established, which is coming from 1,000 years. It's not something new. It's from Umar and Khattab at the time. It's established in that community, and they're disciplined to that. And now we want to like move the goalpost and just think, what's going to happen? Taraweeh will disappear, you know, or become minimized and so forth. So it'll become unimportant, like some people say it's not even important. So why there's certain things that if you destabilize it, the community, Muslim Ummah, will lose it. It'll become abnormal to do the right thing. So the majority view, however, of the scholars is that it is permissible, mubah, to stick to a madhab. Qadi Iyad said there is ijma, consensus of the Muslim, to be followed off and study according to their madhabs. Ibn Hubayr Wazir described the four madhabs as the ummah has consensus that is permissible to follow any of them. Not wajib, permissible. Ibn Farhun says there is consensus of the people to imitate the madhabs. There is an agreement of the ulama to follow and be guided by the madhabs, to study their books and to attain understanding in deen according to them. It is there is a view I mentioned about that later scholars, you've seen all the madhahib, they're very, very strict because they can see that people will be playing games, mixing the madhahib and follow their desires, which is haram in Islam. To follow your desires, your lusts in Islam, in ahkam, is haram. And there's a serious consideration where if you mix, sometimes you mix a act from different madhahib, it might not be valid according to any of the schools, right? For example, in wudu, like Bismillah, according to some schools, is wajib. And if you intentionally forget it, your wudu is invalid. So someone comes along, well, in Hanafi school, it's not compulsory. So I'll take that view, right? Then I said, I'll only, a certain act of the wudu is only required to do this much. I don't have to do the mouth and nose. I just have to do the face, right? On and on, and until you get a wudu, you can do like a bare minimum wudu, taking the lowest common denominator of all of that. But it's not. It will only, that wudu might not be valid according to all the schools. And the classic example given of talfiq, which is that mixing of madahib in an invalid way according to all the schools. It's not valid in Shafi madhab, Hanafi, Maliki. So he's taken bits of Hanafi madhab but and bits of the Shafi madhab, but like the nikah, the classic example is given of nikah, where the Malikis don't really require witnesses, but they have to announce, right? And the wali is not a condition for the validity of nikah according to the. So if you follow all, if you do that tatabbu, following the concessions, tatabbu rukhas it's called, in all the madahib, you will end up at the end of making zina halal. But you're using Islam, and the nikah will not be valid according to any of the schools, right? So this is, it's a serious matter, and it requires cautious in fatwa in dealing with this. Imam Ibn Hazm, however, the view, it was from Spain, the Zahiri Imam, he followed the Zahiri school. It should be known that anyone who takes all the views of Hanifa, or all the views of Malik, or all the views of Shafi, or all the views of Ahmed, from he who is well versed in forming a judgment, from he who is well versed in forming a judgment, that indeed he has opened the consensus, he has opposed the consensus of Ummah. However, this is his view, but if you can see already he's that he who is well versed, right, it already he's put a condition, right? What he is not intending here is definitely is unqualified scholarship. If it's qualified, then you shouldn't follow, right? So there's two ways to approach. One is a person sticks to one of the madhabs, right? Or he asked the alim. He trusts, is confident in his deen and his trustworthiness. Like he's reliable in his deen, and he's truthful and trustworthy. A scholar of Islam that he sees. Arabs have different words, ulama rabbayun, the ulama that are godly, pious, right? Or the ulama of taqwa, the ulama that have taqwa, right? They are particular about the apparent Sharia, and so the heart only Allah knows, but they are particular about the apparent Sunnah and the Sharia. So a person go, historically, that was your local imam. He used to be an alim. Most people prayed Salat in the masjid regularly in one masjid. They wouldn't go so far. And that imam was their alim, their mufti, and everything. My father, rahmullah, said that every imam is really, in reality, is performing the function of a mufti. People are going to ask questions from him. He answers their questions. At a basic level, he's doing the function of a mufti, right? So in that sense, like, so he had these two options: to learn a madhab in some sort of semi-formal way, he sticks to madhab, or follow an alim that he relies upon without knowing or understanding madhabs or anything like that, right? These are the two options available to the average Muslim. The tamadhu means that he sticks to the madhab, its restrictions, its ideals he takes, and its concessions he leaves, right? And he never goes outside the madhab. And remember that taqleed, following a madhab, is at different levels according to the level of knowledge of the person. Imagine, like Imam Ahmad rahimullah, he said the conditions, like, if you're not a muqallid, then you're mujtahid. But what is the standard of ijtihad? If you look at Imam Ahmad, when he was asked, if you, if like, can you do ijtihad? Like, can you give fatwa when you know 100,000 hadith by heart? He said no. He said 200,000. He goes no. 300,000. No. He said that 300,000. He said, I hope that he can, right? Like, he gets barely past to be a mujtahid. That was their standard of ijtihad, right? So some people say that the later scholars, the Usuli scholars I mentioned before, that they were restrictive, that they made it hard, right? Some weak people say they made it hard. But if you look at their standard, they are allowed at what the muftis that we have today, but based on their standard. While if you follow the early imam standard of what a mujtahid is, someone who can do ijtihad and exercise, do fatwas, they were like that standard, they made it much more harder. So for the weak people of later eras, they've said the Usuli scholars made it hard. But if you compare them to the early scholars, they made it easy, right? I hope you understand what I'm saying. Today, unfortunately, I have students of madrasa. One of the sheikhs, Sheikh Amir, quoted, he said that I'm doing ijtihad and I'm doing tarjih, preferring one view of the other, from Imam Shafi's Risala book, right? And so the sheikh said to him, I want you to read a page of Risala. And if in every line your mistakes are less than the number of lines in the page, right? Right? Like people say, we are men and they are men, right? Imam Shafi is a man and I'm a man, so I don't have to follow Imam Shafi. But you can't read one page of what Imam Shafi has wrote without making mistakes. All right? So this is like how the lack of scholarship, the level of scholarship. Of course, as soon as you start reading in the first line, there's two, three mistakes. These are Arabs who studied Sharia. They struggle to read sometimes without mistakes. All right? So if Nas comes and clashes with Madhab, some say it conflicts with this view. So some say that if a text comes of a hadith, Quran, and it explicitly clashes with a madhab, right? However, this assumption is wrong. The assumption is that the imam didn't know the narration, or the imam didn't intentionally, astaghfirullah, that he left the hadith. This cannot be the case. The imam knew the hadith and he processed it in a systematic way, based on all the other narrations and all that is there on a sound, systematic way. Right. The next, this was like something you saw before as well, but just an overview. The four levels, eras. Obviously, these are not the only one that we're certain about. Like, we can say this is a definitive era, is the establishment of Islamic law. Right, which is the in the lifetime of Rasulullah. Something cannot be done after. It's based on wahi, revelation. So this started with Rasulullah's, first revelation, ended with the day that the moment that he passed away. Yeah, but this is a statement that is thrown around. The hadith didn't reach him. Like, as an example, like, the hadith didn't reach him. A simple case of that. There's a narration where the person is using the hadith to debate against Imam Ahmad on a certain issue. I think it's about where to place the hands in Salat. Now it slips on mine. See how bad our memories. And the thing is that the judgment of the hadith is from Imam Ahmad himself, right? So we have to be careful when you make that assumption. And you're talking about a school that's multi-generational, right? And the foundation era of the school. And then you have like the imams of hadith that are involved in those schools, like Qadi Bi Yusuf, like for example in the Hanafi school, right? The idea that Imam Hanifa, his council of muhaddisin and fuqaha and so forth, I want to see evidence of that specifically in what specific case. You know, these are very few rare instances. They should not be projected that somehow the whole school is defunct and so forth. But you have to show the evidence of that and how it was applied by that school and why wasn't it applied. But the assumption that they disregarded the hadith intentionally, or that they didn't know the hadith, you'll have to prove that, right? That they didn't know the hadith. Like, but you know it, like, because you picked up Riyad al-Salihin and or Umd al-Ahkam, and you know it, and they didn't know it. This is, in many cases, far-fetched. All right. So first stage is established, which is the passing away of Rasul. The moment that Rasul passed, the first stage is closed. That's a definite fixed time in history. The stage before the madhabs, right? It's about until after 100 after Hijrah, the eras of the madhab, right? So you've got the intermediate stage of Sahab and Tabi'in. Then you have the and then you have this long period, like a 1200 years until the modern era, pre-modern era, that lasts 150 years approximately. This last 150 years, you can see there's like this long stretch of the era of the Madahib, 1200 years. And you know, so let's go through what these changes are. So the milestones regards to fiqh in the modern era. So the last era, we just have a look at that. The first thing that occurs in this era is the printing of fiqh books in a scale that was unseen before, right? We'll go through the other matters later. So before colonialism, it's a very long period, right? 1200 years, a century, the era of the Madahib, a century, like every century there was, like, let's say the 16th century and 7th century were very similar. The mode of transportation is very similar. There might have been changes, but it wasn't a huge leap, right? And the 14th century, people still riding horses, riding donkeys and whatnot. There wasn't a huge leap and transformation in the world, right? And but even if we see in our own lifetime, in the last 50 years, and we see the rapid changes that are happening, the information age, you know, now it's like we the digital age, all these sort of things, like the last 100 years, the speed of change is a lot, right? However, unfortunately, in this sort of like people suffering from, and they mean well, and they want the ummah to do well, but they misplace the rapid development as though the era before the pre-modernity or the pre-modern age, like 150 years ago, was like the last 300 400 years was somehow the era of Jumud, stagnation. If the Messiah, because the world wasn't changing, so the fiqh was already developed to the point of that if a question comes, people's answers, you know, after a while, the questions will stop because the answer's already provided. You understand? So we have to keep answering new, like a new question will come, like drop shipping halal. So 5 years ago, we never heard of it. 10 years ago, we never heard of this. Now an answer has to be provided. An answer is provided, right? Sometimes it's slow to get the answer, right? Crypto, on like the list of things. I'm not going to answer it, discuss that now. But these developments are happening so rapidly, but they're getting answered. So to say the era of stagnation, no, there wasn't actually a requirement for answers because all those questions have been answered, and if anybody asks, they'll get their guidance for their deen. But this has resulted in certain. In certain quarters, a call for a like a total uprooting of all fiqh and rebuilding it from scratch. You've built a very strong castle, very strong building, and so you're going to uproot it and rebuild a house from scratch, right? But the house has not the castle that is built is very strong already. It'll stand for another 1,000 years, right? But you're miscalculating and say, no, we have to adjust and change it. We have to renew it. We have to invent a new usul of fiqh. And every attempt that has been made in the last 100 years for that always falls flat on his face, because they, the people who do that, encourage that and push that, they always, there's like, for everything they try to change, there's like all these contradictions that come, and it doesn't work, right? So trying to make a new building for the sake of building, as opposed to its necessity. The printing of books, I won't go into too much, but it's very self-evident. In the past, people just used to write copies. At the feet of many, the footsteps of many masjids, people used to be sitting there as copyists. So a book was, someone used to come, give it to those people, pay them, and give out, they separate the chapters, like say 20 chapters, give 20 people. Each person transcribes a new chapter. They put it all together, bind it. Here's a new book, like a new copy of the book. That's how it used to be done. It said one of the ulama, he transcribed the Sahih Muslim 7 times. And when he died, I think someone saw in a dream, he was resting and he's saying, I like I'm now resting from transcribing, because he got so tired in this life, right? Of transcribing, copying out. I mean, just think about dipping in the ink pot, writing. Imagine if they had pens or computers like we have today. These 10, 20, 30, 40 volume books were written by hand by the ulama. Dipping into ink pot writing. And many encyclopedias were prepared, books within the madhabs were prepared. And in the recent era, tahqiq came. Now, students of knowledge, like I'm in a library. I personally don't like having books behind my back. I don't know, I find it strange. I don't want to like project like this is my authority, but also I feel weird having putting books behind me. People like that as a decor, it's probably fine. So I am sitting among books, and these books, like I have a library here, at here, and a library in the madrasa, like they're accessible. Students of knowledge have libraries now that even ulama didn't have in the past. The amount of access that we have to books. Books are expensive, difficult to make. Students, my father, rahimullah, he mentioned to me that he saw it. We're from northwest of Pakistan, the tribal areas, and he mentioned to me that that he saw with his own eyes as a child, students making their own pens and making, there was a certain plant that they used to make their own ink. And he saw with his own eyes that students were making their own paper. I mean, that is in like 80, you know, in the last 80 years, right? The amount of effort that the ulama made. So anyway, Sheikh Ahmed goes through a lot of like books and different encyclopedias in the madhabs. We're not going to remember all those names and which one's reliable and the latest tahqiq, and a lot of effort, especially in the Gulf countries, for the Hanbali mothers specifically. A lot of manuscripts been brought out. Ulama have checked and revised and checked against multiple manuscripts of the author and other ulama, students, so forth, put together, compared, notes are checked, and so forth. And the many manuscripts not published until now. They're available, but they haven't been, and they're being digitized, and ulama having any access to it. There are books being published that never been in circulation. They disappeared. They're in libraries in manuscript forms in India. I think the biggest collection of manuscripts, because the Muslim of India was so wealthy, the biggest manuscript, I think, is Rampur or somewhere, if I remember correctly, is the biggest collection of like books that were written in Makkah Mukarramah at some point ended up in India, because Muslims could afford and pay and buy it, and they had these huge libraries that the rulers supported. So, but the printing press changed all of that. And probably in our time, you know, like the internet has changed that as well. Like the books, the availability of books, resource now, like I can have in my computer like 10,000 books that I've accessed. That was like, how are you going to carry that? You know, and how are you going to think? As long as we read them, inshallah, Allah gives tawfiq to read them and benefit from them. My father, rahmullah, said something. They wrote them. We don't have time to read them. The Imams of the past wrote them. We don't even have time to open up and read it. May Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala give us understanding and tawfiq. You asked a question regarding the, I'll stop the recording.